This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with director Tiffany Bartok. She has produced a film about a Louisiana makeup artist who died at the age of 40 of brain disease, but made quite an impression in the world that he lived in. Kevin Oquan. We'll talk with Tiffany Bartok about her documentary, which will be appearing at the Louisiana International Film Festival. Former LSU football great and head football coach of the Tigers for 4 years, Jerry Lane Stovall, on his induction in the LSU Hall of Distinction Friday night. Also, we'll hear from Dr. Rebecca Gee, the Secretary of the Department of Health, on the budget conditions at the state's largest agency. Those continue, of course, and we'll talk with Dr. Gee about this. And we'll also hear from Amy Britton, Washington Post reporter, on her groundbreaking stories about Charlie Rose and others. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. It's a pleasure to share the microphone with you, our producers today, Ali Baltazar and Rebecca Dill. And your number is 877-217-5757. And you can call in Baton Rouge at 297-5633 and send us an email if you so choose to talk@talklouisiana.org. Busy show today. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Jerry Stovall, the man who not only coached the LSU football Tigers, but was a Heisman Trophy runner-up in the year of 1962. Coach Stovall will be inducted in the LSU Hall of Distinction Friday night. And also on the show, we'll hear from Dr. Rebecca Gee, who has a budget update with the state's largest agency, and Amy Britton, a Manship School graduate who works for the Washington Post and broke the story about Charlie Rose. She's back in town for a forum at the Manship School, and she'll talk about her work as well. We begin with Tiffany Bartok. She is a director and will be involved in the Louisiana International Film Festival next week. And the Louisiana International Film Festival is an underwriter of WRKF. Her story, Tiffany's, is Larger Than Life, the Kevin Oquan story. And in some circles, this man was regarded as one of the top makeup artists of all time. He's from Louisiana. And in the fashion heyday of the 1990s, he was the guy who was doing the makeup for supermodels and other people like Cher. And go down the list. If you were somebody, Kevin Oquan was doing your makeup in those days and getting about $6,000 a session for some of his work for some of the major magazines like Vogue and Cosmopolitan. It's quite a story. And the director is Tiffany Bartok. And good morning to you, Tiffany.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Well, how did you get involved with this story?
Well, my background is in makeup. You know, I did makeup. That's how I met my husband, doing his makeup for on set. And so Kevin was always, you know, an icon, something you would aspire to be, learn from. You know, growing up in the industry, and everybody had his books. So we were thinking about what our next project would be, and I knew that there was a retrospective about Kevin in L.A. at a makeup show, at a makeup convention. And so we sent an intern there to shoot it, and when she came back, we just started picking away at interviews, and one thing led to another.
Well, he was quite... the luminary in this field, and yeah. As I noted, died at the age of 40, but went to New York as a young man and took the town by storm. How did he burst onto the scene?
Oh, with sheer force. He was sort of trying to escape the feelings of being a misfit in Louisiana. He was, you know, a tall, lanky, gay guy, very outspoken, and bullied a little bit. And he went to New York to sort of escape that life because he felt like he was destined for more. He was an amazing artist, a visual artist. And so he transferred that to makeup. And then he went from Baton Rouge to New York. And everything sort of went from there. He sort of skyrocketed to fame pretty quickly.
Well, I'm told as a young man he had issues, was bullied at school in terrible ways. Do you go into this in your film about him?
Yes. Definitely. I mean, that's the first thing that you would learn about him when you met Kevin. He never really got over it, of course. I mean, it was, teachers even bullied Kevin, you know, just walking down the street. He never hid from who he was, and he was very outspoken. And, you know, people had a lot of problems with that, obviously. So, yeah, he never really got over that, and he was adopted. So he just always was really searching for who he really was and trying to feel comfortable in his own skin.
Well, he moved to Baton Rouge, and I understand he had some problems here as well.
Yeah, from Lafayette to Baton Rouge. And in Baton Rouge, yes, he was arrested in the, you know, department store and sort of frisked and humiliated with his friends. And they're all in the movie as well, Jed and Scotty. And, you know, yeah, he was like, this town is not for me. Get me out of here. So he ran to New York, where he was much better off.
Well, his bio says he was assaulted by a security guard at Godshaw's,
yes,
a local department store that we're familiar, yes, with, who, and many of us shopped there and had great experiences, but apparently Kevin's experience was not very pleasant.
No, absolutely, yeah. He was sort of, I think they thought he was shoplifting or doing something duplicitous, and of course he was just shopping.
Well, he realized he was gay at the age of six, and mm-hmm. How did his family respond to this?
Well, at first, of course, they were shocked, you know, and mostly the attitude was, you can be like that, but you're going to have a really hard life. So, you know, they really tried to change his mind. This is a time when you thought that you could do that. You know, you could be like, no, don't, let's not do this. Let's fix this. Let's turn this around. Let's, you know, forget about that. And so his mom would show him articles about, you know, saying that basically if he went this way, he would turn into a monster. But of course his mother and father both came to terms with everything over, you know, due course, and they were wonderful parents in the end, and, you know, accepted him fully, and his family fully accepts him now for all of that. So nobody had a problem with it, you know, from probably midway in his life.
The film is Larger Than Life, the Kevin O'Quinn story. It'll be showing at 5:15 Saturday the 21st at Perkins Row, where the Louisiana International Film Festival is holding court, as it has for the last several years. And the director is Tiffany Bartok. And this is a story about Kevin O'Quinn, who many may not be familiar with, but in his world, he was at the top of his game. And it started in 1984 when he was all of 22. He collaborated on Revlon's Naked's line. What happened? What happened with this?
Well, he was the first creative director, and it was amazing because nobody at that age, he was a baby, and so he sort of took the world by storm, and he was the boss. He was the one you answered to. He was the one that came up with all the ideas, the campaign, and it was really revolutionary because it was like a natural but pronounced look, and it sort of changed the course of the beauty industry. It was, you know, a very, very successful line.
And in 1986, the first, I think it was his first Vogue cover shoot, and it was with none other than Cindy Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
How did those two work together?
Oh, great. Wonderfully. They were, you know, fast friends, and, you know, all the way up until the end, you know, she and him were both from small towns, and, you know, they came up together, and they were very, very close, very close.
Well, I'm told, Tiffany, his motto, Kevin's, was that it was far more important to help a woman feel beautiful no matter what, and that makeup was his tool for helping her discover herself.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really well said. Yeah, anybody with a good heart deserves to look and feel beautiful. So he'd make Roseanne Barr look like $1 million bucks. He never discriminated You know, he would, Kate Moss said that he would take her assistant. Nobody would ever do that. And he'd be like, you too, you come along, you get to, you know, look. It was like the Oprah of makeovers. You get to look beautiful, you get to look beautiful. You know, he never discriminated. And if you were a good person and he sensed that, he wanted to make you feel the best with makeup.
Well, here are just a few of the clients that Kevin had. Whitney Houston, Cher, Liza Minnelli, Janet Jackson, Tina Turner, Gwyneth Paltrow, Lisa Marie Presley, Courtney Love, Vanessa Williams, and then all these models, starting with Cindy Crawford and going from there. He was only 40 years old. Obviously, if he had not died, he could still be going. But in September of 2001, he was diagnosed with a rare pituitary tumor. What happened in his final days?
Yes. So he had been, you know, experiencing a lot of fatigue and pain, you know, and thinking it was stress and the work schedule. And so he was, you know, treating it as we all do with, you know, painkillers and whatnot. So then when he was diagnosed, he realized, like, oh, my gosh, this is a much more serious thing. And then what was happening is his growth hormone was accelerating. So he was literally outgrowing his body. It was a disease called acromegaly. And so he had a surgery to get that removed. But at this time, you know, he was already self-medicating. And so that sort of got to be a big mess, you know, and his liver gave out from toxicity at the liver, you know, Tylenol toxicity. So it was just a very unfortunate sort of train wreck of medical issues. And
well, we do have to roll, but it's this fine story from Tiffany Bartok about a Louisiana legend in the makeup industry, larger than life, the Kevin Aucoin story, showing next Saturday at the Louisiana International Film Festival. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. We switch gears now, and we're joined by a true LSU legend, Jerry Lane Stovall, the pride of West Monroe, number 21, Heisman Trophy runner-up, 1962, closest balloting to date for the Heisman. He almost won, but he didn't. And then, of course, he went on to the National Football League, played 9 years with the St. Louis Cardinals, was a three-time All-Pro, and came back home and ultimately became head coach of the Fighting Tigers for 4 years and was also the athletic director at Louisiana Tech. And for the last several years, Jerry Stovall has been the president and CEO of the Baton Rouge Area Sports Foundation, now Sports BR. Good morning, Coach Stovall.
Well, good morning. How are you doing, Jim?
I'm doing well, and it's always great to hear your voice, and what a story you have. Some highs and lows, mostly highs, and you'll be inducted in the LSU Hall of Distinction Friday night, Coach Jerry Lane Stovall. It's been quite a voyage for you, hasn't it?
Well, it has, and for both of us. You're going to be right there with me. Everybody needs to know you're going to be inducted as well.
Well, thank you. But you're the marquee guy. I was not runner-up for the Heisman. And you love LSU, and we've talked probably hundreds of times through the years. And you have told me the 4 years you were in school were the most vivid of your life.
Well, they were. If anybody that plays a sport and is on athletic scholarship has as much fun as Judy, my wife, and I did have, because we were married middle of my junior year, to be able to go through the kind of experience that we did with the fantastic fans and the wonderful players. Jim, what can you do to top that? And you got some of the best college football coaches ever. You've got perhaps the finest athletic trainer ever, and you cannot get away from Herman Lang, who was his assistant. So, you know, it was in a world then where everybody that you were associated with was trying to find out if your skill set could take you to a high level, and you worked on that academically and everything else. So it was fun, though. If people had as much fun as I did, man, they had a hoot of a time. We loved it.
Well, it was quite an odyssey, and you had a long-time goal to come back and ultimately become the coach, and you achieved that goal, but in the most unusual and tragic way. How was it in January of 1980 when you first received word that Bo Ryan had been killed in a plane crash, and secondly, Paul Dietzel asked you to step in and become head coach?
Well, that's where it gets cloudy, and you sit back and said, my goodness. I wanted to be the head football coach at LSU. I thought that I had been well prepared by the people that I played for in college and in pro, and I felt like that the people I'd coached for, who had been Coach Dietzel and Coach McClendon, had prepared me for a role as a coach at the collegiate level. But at the cost, you know, that was something that just came out of the blue. It was a pure accident. And I don't know that anybody could ever explain it, because you get into a mode where now you have to be protective of your squad, of your university, of its reputation. The problem with us was trying to make sure that, I had not seen and recruited any of the players that the coaches under Bo had. So my first responsibility was just to sit down and get the name, address, and phone number, call their mom and dad, talk to the mom and dad, and talk to the young man, and just let them know that your son's scholarship is still in action and there. If he wants to continue to plan to come, we certainly want him to, but if he feels like he needs to go somewhere else at this point in time, we'll surrender the scholarship and won't hold him to it. So the idea was to try to, in the moment of tragedy, try to elevate the image that our university had. I don't think there was a way that we could sit down and go right back now and reevaluate these players in film again with the idea that, hey, we know better than the previous staff. So the idea, one, was to protect the integrity and the character of our athletic department and our university at all costs.
And then you became coach and had some very good years, including 1982. National Coach of the Year was Jerry Stovall. And 10 months later, you're fired.
Yeah. that happened, really. You sit back and you look at it and said, my gosh, we thought we were doing a pretty good job. And I've always had a short list of people that I want to bring and be a part of the administration or management of whatever business I'm involved in. And we have some quality coaches. You start talking about guys like Pete Jenkins that I'd coached with at South Carolina, which was my first coaching job as an assistant. And all of a sudden, Pete's our defensive line coach. We got Buddy Nix that came in. You know, they had Florida and Auburn and Alabama background. So we had the ability by reputation of the university and the athletic department to recruit some good coaches as well as good athletes. So I thought that the firing was premature. I thought that we had the ability and improving the number of the young men that we were trying to fit into the mode of play, and we as a staff had not recruited. So it's difficult sometimes, you know, it just takes you a longer time. Mm-hmm. To be able to place your young men. But it's one of those things that happens, and there's not a thing in the world you can do about it. So you can't win every game, and you can't win every route and bow that you have, so you just go on your way.
Well, you're 76, and you were 38 when you were hired. So according to my math, you're exactly double what you were when you were hired as head coach. And LSU was the site of your greatest triumphs and lowest depths of your career. What does the LSU experience all these years later mean to you?
Oh, my goodness. Just for you to know, I've been sitting in here in my office most of the morning trying to decide between a poem by Robert Frost and a poem of another gentleman to try to explain what happened. See, Jerry Stovall was one of five, as you know, Jim. I had four younger sisters. Nobody in my family had ever been to college. And I wanted very much to be able to want to go. And when I was recruited, I think Coach Abner Wimberly came up one time to North Louisiana, not just to recruit me. I think what he did was just look at one, you know, black and white grainy film I checked my grades to make sure they were good, but I was not one of the young men that was offered a scholarship in the initial deal. And they had 52 scholarships available. They offered all 52, and all 52 were accepted. My problem was that none of them had Jerry Stovall's name on it. So you sit back and make the best of it. Louisiana Tech had offered me a scholarship, as had Northeast. So plan A became to go to Northeast, right across the river, and probably take me 6 years to get my undergraduate degree, but be able to do that and stay home. And that seemed like a good plan. And then all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, Coach Wimberly calls Dad and says that one young man of the 52 decided that he didn't want to play at LSU, and would I still have an interest? And I did, and we did, in fact, sign with LSU. Jim, I wish I knew that young man's name, the one that said, I'm not coming. I would really love to have the opportunity to call him and just thank him, you know, and let him know that, man, I know you, I'm sure you had a wonderful career, but you made my career possible. So, Jim, when you start thinking about hope and wishing, you got to be real careful and make sure you never lose sight of your hope. That it's got to be stronger than your willingness to surrender.
Well, Coach, it is an honor to be affiliated with you in any way. And come Friday night, we'll both be in tuxedos along with Art Favre and Walt Leger. And Kelly Spears will be there. She's one of the inductees.
Yeah.
And then the others, the late Mel Didier. So it is a class that is highlighted by you, and I'll see you in a couple of nights. Thank you, Coach.
I'm looking forward to it, pal. Thank you much.
Take care. See you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Very soon. And we're back after this pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and if you're dialing in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, and the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We're pleased to have, as a return guest, she's been with us a few times, Dr. Rebecca Gee. She is the Secretary of the Department of Health, the state's largest agency, and there, of course, have been some innovative moves by this administration, some praised, others vilified, and one of those that has people on both sides shouting either yay or nay is the Medicaid expansion. And yesterday, the state unveiled a report showing how it's going. And good morning to you, Dr. Gee.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to talk with you as always. Tell us about what you view as a very positive thing for the state. Why has Medicaid expansion been something that you believe has worked very well?
You know, it's hard to vilify the Medicaid expansion, Jim. It's like saying I won the lottery and I'm so disappointed it's only $500 million. I wish it was $600 million. I mean, come on. The Medicaid expansion has been the biggest blessing this state has had from an economic perspective in a generation. Not only has it made people healthier, but we have brought over $3.5 billion of new economic activity to the state and 19,000 new jobs because of the expansion. So this is great news.
19,000 jobs, and how many people are covered now who were not before?
Sure, and this is a study by Jim Richardson from LSU that found these jobs. Now, we have over 470,000 people. Most of them are working, so if you make minimum wage, you are on Medicaid. And working people in this state prior to Medicaid expansion just didn't have access to anything but an emergency room. So this is, you know, colonoscopies, breast cancer screening, primary care, addiction treatment, so lots of exciting advancements in care. But the economic picture is so much more rosy because of the expansion. These were dollars that were going to California and Michigan and Florida and Massachusetts. Now are coming to our state to help us in our economy, and we sure need it, Jim.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Rebecca Gee. And a listener notes at talk@talklouisiana.org that Mrs. Margaret's, saying Bobby Jindal, the former governor, refused the Medicaid money, saying it was a budget buster. Why is this administration right and Governor Jindal was wrong, in your estimation?
Well, the same people work for me now that do the numbers that work for Jindal, and what they tell me is he doctored the numbers. You know, he basically made them put in ridiculous assumptions that were not realistic into the model so he'd make them look bad. And those models are just wrong. I mean, we have models from Michigan, models from Massachusetts and Ohio and Arkansas. And, you know, they show, as do ours, in terms of the practice of the expansion years into it, that the economy is better. And now our real numbers show, you know, we expanded on the governor's first full day in office expanded. So we've been at this for a while. And now our experience shows that our numbers are better. So this, It was a matter of politics that, you know, Bobby Jindal just simply didn't want to do it because he was running for president. And it was a bad thing for the state. Many people lost their lives probably because of lack of health care. And we certainly lost billions of dollars because of his decision.
Well, if the governor, the previous one, had taken the money when it was available, would the situation, in your view, be better now, or would it be about the same or even worse? Well, how would it be if Governor Jindal had taken the Medicaid money as soon as it was available, I think back in, 2011?
Yeah, well, if Governor Jindal, I mean, we've brought in $3.757 billion new dollars in economic activity just in 2017. That's $176 million in state and local tax receipts. So if Governor Jindal had done this sooner, we might not be in the pickle we're in now, frankly, with this budget crisis. We would have been in a lot better footing. And the Medicaid expansion had helped save TOPS last year. It helped save budget cuts from other areas because we've saved $317 million of state general fund on this program. So this is a good deal. It's federal dollars coming to Louisiana. It's our taxpayer dollars coming back home. We're saving money and improving the economy, 19,000 jobs, $3.5 billion in new economic activity. And that's certainly what it helped in the general years, just like it's helping us now.
How much is the state match as far as what the state has to put up to get this money?
Yeah, so for the $3.57 billion, the state had to put up $47 million. So I think you and I would agree that's a pretty darn good deal.
877-217-5757, Jim on Highland Road. Jim, you're on the air with Dr. Gee, Secretary of Health for the great state of Louisiana. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. And, Dr. Gee, I appreciate the great job you're doing. I was involved with the security system. I would like to know what the occupancy is of the New Orleans facility and how many beds are open in that facility and how well it's being utilized.
Jim, that's a great question. I can't give you that off the top of my head, but what I will tell you is they're making progress, and the last time I looked, it was a little bit around 80% occupancy, which is a pretty decent number for a hospital of that size, given that it's still ramping up. It's a hospital that trains the doctors, both Tulane and LSU, and their med students, has a level one trauma center and a burn unit, and is up and running with a brand new primary care building on that campus. So things are going well. Of course, if the budget cuts happen, that building will close, and we would have spent nearly $1 billion on that new facility for naught. So, it's going well. It's providing great opportunities for training. There's always things that could be done better, but it certainly has ramped up over the past few years.
Now, that facility, of course, was at a huge cost, I think over $1 billion. Was, on the whole, was it a good good decision to build it?
Yeah, I mean, I won't speak to that. I mean, that these decisions were made during Katrina and the aftermath of Katrina in terms of what the city and the leadership felt should be done. It's there now, and it's a beautiful facility, and it's a great place for doctors to train.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Rebecca Gee, who says the state has benefited exponentially from the Medicaid expansion. David in Atlanta. David, you're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Rebecca Gee.
Good morning. And, Jim, you stole my thunder, but there's a study at NOLA.com in the Times-Picayune newspaper. And, Doctor, may I praise you and Governor John Bel Edwards for having the decency, the courage, and the kindness and the foresight to expand or
implement the expanded Medicaid under Obamacare because lives have been saved. The state's gross domestic product has been expanded. Revenue has been increased. And for the love of God, I'd like one opponent to that in the conservative Republican Party in the legislature who would not pass that, and as well as former Governor Bobby Jindal, who opposed it. For the love of God, how wrong they were, and what in the name of creation itself, could what reasons could they have ever used to oppose such a wonderful program? It's mind-boggling.
All right, Dr. Gee, would you wish
to brother?
I imagine you like that call.
Yeah, call in again.
All right, Marie in Baton Rouge. Thank you, David. Marie asks, is there a threat to doctor training in Louisiana due to budget cuts?
Oh, for sure, Marie. You know, so Bobby Jindal made the decision, for good or for ill, to, you know, the state has an obligation to train doctors. Nearly every state in the nation, other than really tiny northwestern states, have med schools. And he said, listen, we're not going to put state general fund into this anymore. We're going to privatize all this, and the partners are going to pay for those buildings, and they're going to pay for the training of the med students. And he privatized it so they pay leases so that we can help offset that big expensive building and so on. And this whole program is at risk. It's zeroed out in our budget, zero. And that's not just for New Orleans, but it's Shreveport, it's Alexandria, it's Lake Charles, it's Baton Rouge, the lake where we train a lot of docs. All of it is zero, and these guys are not going to operate these facilities for free, and the legislature tries to make it look like there's another alternative. There's not. No one's going to operate these hospitals for free, period, end of story. And they need to raise this money if we're going to have med schools in this state. And, you know, the revenue, you know, we're looking at the revenue estimating committee. There might be a few more dollars, but they're going to have to raise some revenue if we're going to keep these med schools open.
877-217-5757. We have a little bit more time with Dr. Rebecca Gee, Secretary of the Department of Health. Paul in Opelousas. Hi, Paul. You're on the air with Secretary Gee.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Secretary. Just a question. With the present Congress still trying to reverse the Affordable Care Act, with the advancement that we accepted the money this time, can the next governor decline the funding, or should we just wait on the federal government to say, do away with it, and we're back in the same hole? So what's the plan for the next 8 years that they're trying to reverse this move? And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Sure. Well, this governor's going to be reelected, because I love my job. He needs to be reelected so we can keep doing this good work. But listen, you know, the next governor could do whatever he or she would like. But the bottom line is, if he or she did that, we would be $3.57 billion less in economic activity, 19,000 fewer jobs. So good luck getting reelected after you take away the Medicaid expansion. It's a horrible idea to take it away, and it's bad politics and bad finance.
Well, essentially, both of our U.S. senators voted to do just that. Is there concern that the federal government could take it away?
Well, sure, they could, but they could also take away federal highway funding and so on, and we still build roads. So I think, you know, we make the best decision we can at the time. And so, you know, they tried very hard to undo this, and they failed. And I don't see them coming around talking about it anymore. So I think we are doing what's best for our state. The governor and I are continuing the Medicaid expansion. It's improving lives. It's creating 19,000 jobs. That's
all right, hold tight. We're going to spend a few more minutes with Dr. Rebecca Gee, and then we're slated to hear from Amy Britton, Washington Post reporter. 877-217-5757 is your number, 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. Back after this brief pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. On deck is Amy Britton, the Washington Post reporter, who's done some exceptional work and is back home at the Manship School, where she received her degree not so long ago. We're finishing up with Dr. Rebecca Gee, who's issued a report showing that Medicaid expansion, on the whole, has been, in her view, an extreme move forward for the state of Louisiana when we look at the budget. Stephen on Highland Road, you're on the air with Dr. Gee. Stephen.
Hey, good morning, Jim and Dr. Gee. Dr. Gee, back to the training hospitals. What happens to your doctor population in a state if you don't have training hospitals operating?
All right. What happens?
So we have a couple of problems. One is we signed contracts with these folks a couple weeks ago. They were excited to receive their letters that they're going to start training here July 1st. If on July 2nd there's no funding, we're going to have to find other places for them in other states. And chances are when they go to those other states, if we're able to find spots, they'll stay there. So we're going to lose the docs who will take care of our kids, and we'll lose the docs who will take care of us as we age who are training. Also, people that train these docs need a hospital to practice in. So we have, for example, in Lafayette alone, 800 jobs would be lost. You know, in New Orleans more, and Shreveport more. So this is a lot of jobs that would be lost and doctors who would leave the state.
Well, we thank you, as always, for joining us, and let's keep in touch, and we commend you for your service to our state. Thank you, Dr. Gee.
Thanks, good. Call your legislators. Tell them to fix this budget crisis so we can get on with talking about the future and positive things.
Well, I'm sure that's going to be a topic that we'll be discussing with you sometime very soon. Thank you again.
Thanks so much, Jim. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye. We're joined now by Amy Britton, Washington Post reporter, who will be part of a panel at her alma mater, LSU, the Manship School, tomorrow. It's called Hear Them Roar, Voicing the Truth About Sexual Harassment in Media and Politics. And Amy, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
This is a topic you know well.
Yes. I've spent the last couple of months immersed in reporting about sexual harassment. We broke the Charlie Rose sexual harassment story back in the fall for the Washington Post. So I'm looking forward to the discussion, and talking about the difficulties in doing this type of reporting and the impact that it's had as well.
Well, you mentioned the difficulties. How many roadblocks, challenges, obstacles were there in getting all this information, certainly salacious information, about one Charlie Rose?
There are certainly a number of roadblocks. I mean, in many cases, you are dealing with women who have internalized, the traumatic experiences that have happened to them over the years. You're dealing with people who have not talked about these experiences, in some cases, for more than a decade. So as you're trying to do that reporting and not only, deal with the victim and any emotions that they may be feeling, you're also trying to corroborate what happened, in some cases, years ago, before people necessarily had, Facebook messages to friends. You're asking women, did you save emails? Did you tell your mother? Did you tell a boyfriend? So you're having to do multiple layers of reporting in order to put forward the strongest story possible, that makes clear exactly what happened.
Are you amazed at what's happened to Charlie Rose? It's like the man never existed. And he was, you talk about journalistic icons. He was at the top of his game, both in the commercial television world and in public broadcasting. And suddenly he's gone and never to be seen again, it appears.
I can tell you that I've been an investigative reporter at the Post for just about 5 years now, and as far as impact goes, it's the swiftest impact I've ever seen. We published the story around 4:45 p.m. On a Monday, and within the hour, his show, the distribution was suspended by PBS and by Bloomberg. CBS suspended him, and the next morning he was fired from CBS. And in very few stories do you see that type of impact happen that rapidly. And the reach of the story was tremendous. It was on the list of top 100 most engaged reader time across the world for stories that were published in the year 2017. So you never know when you publish a story, who's going to read it, who's going to react to it. But that type of reaction was remarkable. And then just to see the aftermath of him, people ask me all the time if I've spoken to him or if I know what he's doing. And the answer is no. Even though I feel like I know a tremendous amount about his life and the people that he's affected through these actions, I've never had a conversation with him, and he did not engage with us for our reporting. So all I know is that he's still in New York, and I'm not really sure what he's up to.
Did you try to talk with him?
I did, of course, yes. We reached out to him Before the story, we went. We sent extensive details about what was going to be published, the allegations, you know, the years, the names of the women who were on the record, and offered him a full chance to respond to all of the allegations. We got no response from him. We sent it to his attorney, and, you know, they sent us a statement about, I think, 5 minutes before we published with the deadline that we had set for them. So I would have very much appreciated the chance to hear from him and to hear his perspective, but he did not engage with us at all.
Well, quite often when we hear somebody or watch them, we have one impression that may or may not be consistent with the person. But Charlie Rose, this came as a big shock. I must say that a lot of people were not shocked at Bill O'Reilly. But Charlie Rose, he seemed like such an amiable guy who certainly had a good mind, has a good mind, and was a great interviewer. Were you shocked?
No, but my threshold for being shocked is is a little bit different probably from the average person. I mean, I just, as a reporter, I guess I'm naturally, I would say, a skeptical individual. And if I don't know someone, or if I've never spoken with them or dealt with them as an individual, I view someone like Charlie Rose or Matt Lauer through the prism of who they are on TV. And there's often a disconnect, I know, you know, in the industry for how someone presents on television versus what they are like in real life. You know, I certainly knew that his public reputation was stellar, you know, prior to the publication of this story. But when you hear the stories of, you know, the women who worked with him, or even the men who worked with him, in describing what this environment was like for women on the show and who encountered him, the truth couldn't be denied in this case. And, you know, I'm very confident in our reporting, and what it showed is that he was someone who had used his position of power to, you know, to take advantage of his access to women throughout the years and to mistreat them in the workplace.
What propelled these ladies to come forward and speak on the record?
You know, in talking with them, the story was reported very rapidly. You know, it's one of the fastest investigative pieces that I've done by our standards. We wrote it, reported and wrote it in 17 days from start to finish. I think we started reporting on November 3rd and published it on November 20th. And that was driven by a sense of urgency, I think, for the truth to come forward. You know, the Harvey Weinstein stories have been published by the New York Times. Many people view that type of reporting as opening the floodgates for exposing this type of sexual harassment. And my co-reporter, Erin Carmone, had initially heard about the Charlie Rose allegations back in 2010. And that's one thing that a lot of people, you know, don't realize, I guess, when they read our reporting, is that this in many ways predated, you know, the Me Too movement. So rumors were circulating around New York that he was acting this way towards women, and she tried to check it out then and was unable to get people on the record. And I think that in the year 2017, I don't want to in any way say that it was easy for these women to come forward. Trust me, there were hours and hours of agonizing phone calls that we had with them where they were debating the pros and cons of putting their names in this story. And many people in their lives told them not to do it, that there was no possible upside for coming forward in a story like this. But one of the women who ultimately went on the record, Rhea is her name, she told me that she, for years, had been living in a place of fear of Charlie Rose, and the only reason to stay silent would be because she was still afraid of him. So that was the reason that she decided to move forward as a show that, you know, to the public that she was not afraid of him and he did not have this power over her anymore.
We're about a minute away from the finish line, but how did you get to the Washington Post, Amy, from the Manship School?
It's been a crazy, wild ride, and I'm very fortunate at a young age to be at the Washington Post. You know, I graduated from the Manship School in 2009 and then got my master's at Columbia, started at my first full-time newspaper job at a paper called the Star Ledger in New Jersey, specialized in investigative reporting there, did some reporting about law enforcement and steroids, and, you know, published a big project there and was fortunate enough to make it to the Post. And it's, as you can imagine, it's a very interesting fascinating newsroom to be in right now at this moment in American history. So I feel very fortunate to work among, you know, who I believe are the best journalists in the country.
Well, congratulations, Amy Britton. Tomorrow she'll be at the Manship School. Hear Them Roar, voicing the truth about sexual harassment in media and politics. Do you know the time, Amy?
Yes. It starts at 7 p.m.
Okay, 7 p.m. tomorrow, Manship School. That's it for today. We thank you for joining us. Back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.